This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sivasodhi. It's our Brainwave series. Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar, neurogeneticist in the studio with us. We are going to be discussing something called bionic neurons or synthetic neurons. I mean, we know that neurons fire in the brain. What do these neurons actually communicate? We're going to do a bit of a deep dive on neurons itself before we go into what a bionic neuron actually is. And joining us also is Dr. Noor Azza Hamzait. She's from the Department of Biomedical Engineering, University of Malaya. Dr. Noor Azza has actually done some work focusing on rehabilitation of people with spinal cord injuries and sort of other movement disabilities. How would bionic neurons perhaps help in that sort of in those sort of conditions? So welcome to the show, Dr. Noor Azza. How are you today?
Thank you.
Dr. Azlina, do you just want to go through a 101 about how neurons actually communicate? What are they and how do they communicate in the brain?
Mm-hmm. So if I can take everyone back to what we learned in school in the textbook, if you can just imagine a picture of a neuron. So it has a quite a large cell body, and then typically in the textbook picture they will have these sort of spikes that come out from the cell body, and those are called dendrites. And then there's a long kind of arm, and that one is called an axon, and then the axon ends with what's called a synaptic terminal. So how the neuron is designed is perfectly suited in its function to receive signals as well as to send signals out to the neighboring cells. And how it works is, yes, it does work through an electrical impulse. So in how that electrical impulse is set up is that there's a lot, it's very technical, but basically it's you can generate an electrical impulse through the movement of ions that are from outside the cell into the cell, and from ions that are inside the cell out of the cell. And if you get enough movement of those ions across what's called a membrane, right, across into and outside of the cell, then you generate something that's called an action potential. So I'm sure you can remember action potential, Mira?
Vaguely.
So that's just the technical term for the firing, let's say. So it generates an action potential, and that action potential will move along this long axon track, right to the end of the neuron, and that will, and when it reaches the end of the neuron, it will then cause a release of neurotransmitters. And in most cases, it will cause a release of neurotransmitters. And these are the usual neurotransmitters that we know of, like the dopamine and acetylcholine, for example. And then those neurotransmitters will move across to the next neuron. The next neuron will receive those neurotransmitters using these things called receptors. It's just like a satellite dish, right? So it will capture these neurotransmitters. And when it captures enough of these neurotransmitters, then you then cause this, again, a movement of ions in that neighboring cell, which will then generate another action potential in that next cell, and then so on and so forth. So then that's how you transmit, that's how neurons transmit information from one to another in most cases.
Is that something like an electrical circuit perhaps?
Yeah, so the movement, so it's just like a battery. So the movement of the ions generates an electrical charge, and you can actually measure it. You can measure it in millivolts. Mm-hmm. And it's just like like a battery, an analogy, right?
But yes, yes. Dr. Noor Azza, how would you record study electrical activity of the neurons? I mean, it's not exactly the same electricity that we're talking about.
You can liken it to somewhat similar to what we see on our devices and our plug points and things like that. So as long as you have voltage potential, this potential, it's like voltage, like battery, that's a gap between the ions, then you could have current to flow through it. It's the same principle as any electrical engineer would understand.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So once you can create that voltage potential, you can have current to flow through it. Meaning, when you say current flowing, you mean the ions are
the firing.
the ions are shifting places, right, and then we see it as firing.
Right.
So it's kind of a similar principle of an electronic,
any electrical device.
And then the circuits and how we refer to them. But how would you refer? How would you measure these electrical circuits in the brain in a lab, for an example?
You could measure it directly on the brain, or you could measure it where it comes, where it manifests itself. For example, if you are to stimulate movement of a body part, for example, your fingers or your hands or your legs, you could put electrodes on the muscle, because by right, when the brain produces all these tiny, tiny electrical signals, it gets transmitted all through your spinal cord, and it goes to your muscles and your limbs. So what we can do is actually to put electrodes on the muscle, which reflects what the nerve current sends to the muscle, and we could pick that up, and that's how we can diagnose or evaluate how good the muscle contraction is. So that's where then those are in voltage. You can measure it in milliamps. You can basically look at it as an electrical circuit or an electrical
impulse that can be measured.
But and you can actually even go in the lab, you can also grow the neurons in a dish, and you can use very fine electrodes to actually insert into the neuron itself, and you get an actual measurement. So you can do it directly into the neuron.
Okay, and where does the neuron come from?
So you can grow neurons from, so you can get it from animals. You can make neurons even from human skin cells now, that you can grow them.
Stem cells.
That's right.
So really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and actually some people can, you can even take a brain, usually an animal brain like a mouse or a rat, and then you can slice it, and then after that you can record from it again using these very fine needles.
And there are instances where, and you have accidents and stuff where neurons stop working, right, in the brain. Injury. What else would cause neurons to actually be destroyed or be injured or not functioning as well as it should?
Sometimes the neurons are okay, but the pathway is disrupted. For example, in my research, I do a lot of spinal cord injury-based research. And when you have an injury of any level of your spinal cord, the neurons are fine. But the pathway is like if you have an accident or car accident, the road is blocked. So the signals from the neurons from the brain can't just jump in onto the lower part of the body. That's why you have people paralyzed depending on which part of the injury is. So what we can do is actually to replicate the neuron's function using electrical devices, tiny electrical current. We call it stimulator. And we put it directly as an external device. And we can still activate the existing neurons below the level of injury so that the people with paralysis can actually move their function, their hands.
So you bypass the roadblock.
Yes, exactly. That's
and that can be done.
Yes. We have done many studies, and the most exciting one was to make people with complete paralysis. These are Asia A, Asia B, who has no motor control at all. We put electrodes on their legs. Some are commercial ones, some are the ones we build ourselves. And we make them stand.
Wow.
We make them stand, and they could stand up to 2 minutes, depending on their condition of the muscles, simply because everything is functioning well, as of a normal able-bodied person. The only part that's disrupted is the pathway where it's injured. So that's where the scars, you know, or whatever reason, so the signal can't pass through from the brain downwards. So what we do, we bypass it, put an external device, and they could stand. The only limiting factor is that they can't stand long enough because the muscles are not used to being working that hard, so they get tired quickly and things like that. But by right, if you do stimulation, enough stimulation routine, they can get healthy, the muscles can get stronger and things like that.
And if you have the stimulation soon after an accident, they can build those muscles. I mean, the muscles haven't wasted away yet.
True.
Right?
That's very true. That's very true.
That's a lot of hope. I mean, how far are we using this? To what extent?
In PPUM, Hospital University of Malaya, we have the devices as part of the occupational therapy and physiotherapy devices that we prescribe to patients. So they come and they do training, and we sit them on the bike when the bike is equipped with electrical stimulation devices where they can exercise the legs and the arms, and some do pick and place with the grasping of the wrist and hand function. So we are already practicing that as a therapy, as an exercise routine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's no longer experimental then. It is being done.
No.
Okay.
No.
And that's to make sure that the muscles are still active and so that they don't waste away, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And is everybody a candidate? Does it work for everyone?
Specifically for electrical stimulation, I would say, only if they are people who has spinal cord injury who are not eligible for this. Sometimes they have denervated muscle, meaning the muscle, the nerve that goes to the muscle is damaged. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the nerve bundle that is at the end of our spinal cord, usually at the buttocks area. Mm-hmm. Maybe the impact is there so that the nerve bundle itself is broken or damaged or something like that. But if it's somewhere higher, then it might be the pathway. So they're okay. And then some of them may have autonomic dysreflexia, meaning their blood pressure, mm-hmm. because it's parasympathetic and sympathetic responses of the physiological body, sometimes their blood pressure is out of control. Mm-hmm. So if we detect or if we identify patients who have spinal cord injury but they also have autonomic dysreflexia, usually we don't recommend it to them unless they get treatment, or I don't know if there's any specific treatment for that, but yeah.
To stabilize the blood pressure.
Mm, yes.
Okay. So you've spoken about how the pathway of the neuron is affected. Now, what if the neuron itself is not functioning? Is this where the bionic neuron actually comes into play, Dr. Azlina? Mm. Is this what we're discussing today?
Yes. So in cases where, for example, like you have neurodegenerative diseases where you have a group of neurons that die due to many different reasons. One could be because of aging, and then on top of aging, you have some external factors that has caused the neurons to die quicker than they should. So then you would have groups of neurons in the brain that degenerate. So yes, in that case, then it would be useful if we could go in and replace those neurons that have degenerated. And so this is kind of, you know, people are trying to do this already using these stem cells, as Dr. Azah mentioned earlier. You know, you can take the skin from a patient. You can grow those skin cells in a dish, and then you can coax them or you can reprogram them to go back to a much younger stage of life, so back to a stem cell, right? So a stem cell is basically a very, very early time point in development before it becomes all these other specialized cells like neurons and skin cells and kidney cells, etc. So you can reprogram them back into a more immature form, and then you can then make them become whatever you want. So there have been some studies that actually can turn these stem cells, reprogram stem cells, into motor neurons, into dopaminergic neurons, for example, that neurons that release the dopamine neurotransmitter. And so the idea is that if we can make these neurons outside the body, then could we then put them back into the brain to replace what has been lost? So in that sense, it's people have sort of thought about that idea using the biological cells, but in this recent paper, what they've done is they've actually made an electrical device, sort of like a chip, I suppose you can think about it, that you could insert into the brain that would replace the cells that are damaged.
Synthetic neurons.
Artificial neurons, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
We'll come back and find out more. My goodness. If it's so simple to create them outside, what's so difficult about putting them in the brain is my thought.
Yeah.
We'll come back and find out more up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Mira Sivasuthi. It's our Health and Living segment. It's our Brainwave Brainwave series number 33. Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar, neurogeneticist in the studio. My God, that's a long time, Doctor.
Yeah, I hope you're not bored of me.
No, all this brain talk is really giving me a lot of hope for old age, you know. And in the studio also with us, Dr. Noraza Hamzait. She's from the Department of Biomedical Engineering, University of Malaya. We're trying to understand neurons and what happens when they become affected or destroyed, or, you know, they become injured, they die, you know, neurons die. What happens then? And there's been research that just came out about bionic neurons, in which we include synthetic neurons. However, this was done in rats, Dr. Azlina. I mean, is that necessarily represented? I mean, can we use this, or just help us understand what a bionic neuron is?
Yes, yeah, so basically it's just a fancy word, I suppose, for a neuron that's an artificial neuron or a device that mimics the properties of a neuron. So in this particular case, so if you remember, I mentioned the neuron, it's able to receive information and it's able to pass on that information. So this device is able to do that. It can receive information either from any stimulating device can stimulate it, and then it can then pass on that information to the next cell. So I think that kind of device has been around for a long time.
Yeah. We have a term for it. We call it neuroprosthetics. Mm-hmm. Prosthetic means something that you replace with, like you have prosthetic arm, prosthetic leg. Now you have neuroprosthetic, meaning you replace the function, not necessarily the actual neuron.
Yeah.
But it could be a little chip, it could be a little electrical tiny circuitry that behaves or functions like a natural neuron would.
Yeah.
So as long as you could receive information from other parts of the brain that produce the electrical signal, because the real function of a neuron is to transfer, is to get the impulse, somehow decides what to do with it and pass it on to the next. So if the neuron is broken or damaged or whatever you call it, if you have a device, an electrical device or a little something that could receive that input or stimulation and decide on how much to pass on to the next one, the connecting one, then it's already a neuroprosthesis.
Because actually the property of a neuron, although to generate this action potential, it can be complicated, but how it transmits the information is actually quite simple, right? It's a very fixed amount. So these action potentials, you can reproduce them very easily. They don't have, you know, different neurons don't have different types of action potential. All the neurons behave the same way in terms of an action potential. So it doesn't matter. You don't have to tailor-make different devices for different types of neurons necessarily, but you could have one device that would be able to be applicable to any type of neuron. And then because the property is the same throughout, and also you know that the way the neuron responds is a definite, it's a fixed way. So that's quite easily modeled in an electrical circuit or electronic circuit for the engineers to do.
So if it's simple, why is it taking us this long? I mean, and it's still being done on rats. And if you say you can create neurons outside with, you know, using skin samples and stuff, I'm sure this can be worked out.
It can be, optimistically speaking. There's the expertise required, there's the testing that needs to be done. And anything that deals with human brain, we think it's simple, but there will be people who are over-cautious, over-protective of it. So they might ask for ethical clearance and have you tested in this condition or that condition. So they are, in principle, it's easy, can be done. But they start like, what about the surrounding fluid or moisture, or what about this, or what about that? So those are the things that
That still needs to be optimized, right?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And will this circuitry sit in the brain, or will it be like deep brain stimulation? Because deep brain stimulation, I think it sits somewhere in the neck or somewhere.
Yeah, in sort of on the chest.
On the chest area.
Stimulator.
So will it be something like that? That, you know, deep brain stimulation that's done for Parkinson's,
sure.
patients
yeah.
of Parkinson's?
I think in the future they're thinking that you can just put in this chip, and then the chip will somehow integrate itself into the brain, right? But actually, if you, I was watching some of the interviews of the authors of this recent paper, and the setup that they have is there's a, you know, you still require quite an external setup to stimulate it, to record it. So you still have, so they still showed a computer, and then there were these giant cables that went into a stimulator, which then was connected up to another device to read the response of the neuron. So although they've made this chip, I mean, that's a wonderful first step, but I think it's still a long way to actually thinking about using it for neurodegenerative diseases. And actually, you know, what Azza was saying, that yes, one of the reasons why it hasn't really been used yet is also because we're still trying to understand how the brain works and how the brain integrates information, and even how a single neuron gets information from all the neighboring cells. But how does it, you know, distill it? How does it kind of, okay, I receive information from A, B, C, and D, but how am I going to analyze that information that so that I only send a single output? Because that's what the neuron does. It integrates from many different neighbors, but it needs to take all that information and
decide what else to pass
message.
On. Right.
Yes.
Okay.
So that is still kind of in the process of being understood. Mm-hmm. So even in this paper, for example, they looked the proof of principle of this device that they made. They used very simple circuits, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's very, when you use a very simple circuit, you can show that that device is mimicking the property of the neuron in a simplified way. But when you then try to put it into the brain, then that's going to be, you know, they're going to need to optimize it a lot more.
Okay, yeah. So not as simple as we thought it would be.
If you wanna put it into the brain, I think it's going to be complicated. Mm-hmm. But like as I was saying, mm-hmm. you can have external
yes.
devices,
yes.
and those are quite easy because mm-hmm. then you can play about it outside.
It depends on the function that you want to achieve. Mm. What do you want to achieve? You may not need that much complication. You don't need.
Right.
You may not need that much.
But how would you control it from outside? How would you control these damaged neurons from the outside? How will you get this bionic neuron going from outside? So you were saying if it's
so
not
it's just
embedded
in terms of stimulating, so it would stimulate. So let's say if you have a bionic neuron which now is external to your body, mm-hmm. right? So you would stimulate it somehow,
yep.
and then you would then, once it's stimulated, that signal is then connected up with the neurons in your brain. So
how do you do that? How do you connect that?
So similar to what deep brain stimulation does for Parkinson's disease. So you mm-hmm. have a stimulator pacemaker, which
yeah.
is embedded usually in the chest. And then through electrodes, it then sends it. And you have electrodes that are embedded into a specific part of the brain, which is involved in controlling movement. Mm-hmm. And so those electrodes will pass an electrical signal to the existing neurons in the brain.
Okay.
So you are externally stimulating existing neurons. So what they're hoping to do is, rather than having this giant, you know, this very long electrode, can we make it really small and make it just into a simple chip that, you know, ultimately we can just implant into the brain?
I think the key here is to identify which part of the anatomical or physiological natural body function that we have that could receive that.
Hmm.
So you could seamlessly integrate whatever you create externally. Because as engineers, if we can create it, we can control it. But we need to know if we embed it or integrate it into the anatomical system, if I may say, which plug point should we attach it to?
Right.
So that it talks seamlessly to the natural body. That's where I think this neuroprosthetic issue is still finding its ways.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Its ways, yeah.
Okay. What are some of your concerns about a bionic neuron besides that that you said, which plug point is one issue?
Yeah.
What else?
To determine what means what. Sometimes you, when you are in a control condition, you know this means this.
Right.
A means B. But when you have a series or a mess of signal, you may not know what does it really mean, each of the points. So in computer science or electrical engineering, they have this term called artificial neural network, where they try to mimic or they try to simulate what how the brain works with two nodes and all these branches of many, many nodes in between. So if you have one input or two input, how would it be passed and what are the weightage? So we don't know the weightage of each signal that comes naturally from the brain. We could simulate in a computer or a simulation system that if you have a signal one, signal two, then by training, because brain behaves by training actually, and then you have your hormones and your
I was just going
other
to say,
things. Yeah, hormones is another thing that I don't know enough about to talk, but yeah.
And there are a lot of other things that we don't know at all.
Right. So you can't model the brain perfectly. That's where I think the hard
uncertainties are. Yeah. Are there ethical concerns with bionic neurons?
When it involves human, there will always be ethical concerns.
I mean, put it in my brain and I might be doing the wrong firing. Yeah. Well, weird things.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, in terms of ethics, if it's used to treat a disease or a condition, then people can see the justification in that. But you can imagine, right? Just like in genetic engineering, you know, nobody has any problems with fixing a disease gene, right? But people have issues with if you go in and you try to change that gene to make it a super gene. So just like, you know, in this case, you know, you can imagine that people are now starting to think of, well, can I, if I put in a lot more of these chips, do I somehow enhance brain function? And in that sense, you know, of course, then that will be a huge other ethical question that we'll have to face.
I mean, bionic neurons can actually take over the brain, can it?
Yeah, so
I mean,
so,
there is a possibility.
Well, I mean, you could control your TV remote just by thinking, right?
Mm. Yes.
Yeah, so channel one. Channel two. So just kind of, you know, you can integrate a, you know, Wi-Fi system into that device and just think.
But the question is it worth planting something into your brain just to change the channel?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you can even open up the possibility of it being hacked by someone else, isn't it? I mean, you never know.
Yeah. Nowadays, you can, you know, if people can figure out how to manipulate the software, the problem or the program, potentially.
Are there similar projects like these in Malaysia? Bionic neurons?
There's a lot of there are a lot of people in computer science who are working on artificial intelligence, but they would use it. You know, they're modeling how the brain works in a computer, I'm not sure if there's anybody in Malaysia who's got it as far as these authors would have. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like I said, the idea is not new. What's new is that that these authors, a group in the UK and also in parts of Europe, what they've done is they have, again, been able to advance the technology. So that's the latest. That's what has captured people's interest because they've been now able to make it very small and that it can talk to other real neurons. So, you know, other people probably have done chips that you connect up to electronic devices. But the technological breakthrough has been that this device can actually respond to what the rat neuron is, you know, the chit-chat that's happening within normal neurons or real neurons, and it can respond to that and relay information from real neurons. And so that's been, you know, really exciting.
You know, while you speak about that, I'm just going to distract you a little away from, you know, bionic neurons. Mm-hmm. I mean, you spoke about artificial intelligence. Do you both really think that And there's so much research being done with AI and all of that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you really think technology will be able to, we will be able to digitize the function of the human brain, especially when it comes to cognitive behavior, when it comes to feelings? You know, the robotic work I can imagine can be digitized, but yeah. Do you really think we can digitize?
I don't think we can digitize emotion, empathy, wisdom. Those are the things that I think computers will never be able to surpass us.
Humor.
Yes. Oh my goodness.
Yes.
I've never had a robot tell a joke.
And if they do, it wouldn't
work.
You've heard it before.
It will be very robotic, yeah. Don't you think?
To a certain extent, you could solve the mundane, repetitious things, but the real thing that makes us human, I don't think they will be able to.
Mm. I mean, there's some circuits, like as I was saying, like movement and hearing and vision. Mm. Actually, all that is quite, could be modeled, you know, because it's just, you know, the only thing that the machine would need to learn is like in terms of like the strength that you would need to control that circuit when you want to hold something. So, for example, if you think about holding a pen and holding an egg, you know, the machine needs to recognize that that's an egg. Mm-hmm. And then it would need to learn to hold the egg gently so it doesn't break it, mm-hmm. you know. And so but you could make a machine mm-hmm. learn that through mm-hmm. experience, definitely. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, other kind of softer skills, that will take a while because it's not, even we don't understand it yet. So how would we model it on a computer?
Absolutely.
And machines are always trained by learning, by experience. So if you don't have enough experience input into the system, they will not be able to replicate or they will not be able to decide on it. So, like you say, if it's a joke, you must have heard it before. Originality is not something that machines are very good at.
Yes.
I think so.
So then you get updates all the time, like how you have to update your software, you have to update everything to do with a robot or whatever you mechanize.
Back to humans.
It comes back to the human. Mm. Dr. Hazel, what sort of work are you currently working on at UM?
My work primarily is all related to biomedical engineering and rehabilitation engineering. So I work a lot with people with disabilities, stroke, spinal cord injury. We also start looking at transfemoral amputees. So we build prosthetic legs that are micro-controlled, that you can have sensors inside the microprocessor leg where patients or users don't have to adjust their walking because of the leg, but the leg adjusted to them. Those are the things I do.
It's so cool, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. I'm like, wow. And all of this is being it's being practiced in UM, right? Under rehab and things
rehab,
like that.
And we work very closely with the rehabilitation medicine department of Faculty of Medicine. So we have real feedback, current thoughts and inputs from them as to what works and what doesn't work, so that sometimes engineers like to work in silo where they play with their toys and at the end of the day, nobody wants to use the toy that they play with. So we try very much to keep in contact with the actual stakeholders and the patients and the doctors.
Okay, I remember someone asking a scientist, why is it governments don't listen to scientists? Because, with the novel coronavirus at the moment, some of the scientists had already foreseen this happening way back in 2012, but governments don't listen to scientists. Well, we need to listen to you and the engineers and everybody else for, you know, the sake of so many people who are affected and have disabilities. Now, since it was International Day of Girls and Women in Science earlier this week, for girls or women who are interested in their respective fields, what would you advise them, Dr. Azza?
I particularly love this field where I educate young children, boys and girls, into learning about science, appreciating technology and all this innovative things. So I think the real push factor is the family support and the family expectation of them, of girls into STEM or into engineering and science and mathematics. So if we have enough support, it's the society, it's the environment, and then what we could provide to the girls to be more inspired and feel that they can do this.
Need to marry the right man as well.
I can say that. Yeah. I think I married the right guy that allowed me to do all this. Exactly. Yes.
It's true.
Yes.
Dr. Azlina?
Yeah. I don't know. I never looked at science as being gender based or gender biased. I think it's just important for girls just to be curious. I mean, not just girls, everyone, everyone just to be curious and just explore things, find out, be proactive in finding out information. And, if it leads to a science career, then that's fantastic. But if not, just have that as, how you explore the world. And even if it is in arts or even in something like geography, there's always the thought process that you learn in science can be applied to many other fields. So,
I strongly agree with that. Mm. Like if you have a mum who's a science graduate who ends up not working, she would be an excellent mum to her children because she has all this scientific knowledge about how to boil the right egg.
How to approach a problem.
How to treat a sick child.
Yeah.
That scientific thinking.
Yes.
That reasoning is important. It's not just career based, but it's how you.
It's a way of life.
Deal with things. Yeah.
It helps. Yeah, it does. Your message, Dr. Azlina, on bionic neurons.
My message on bionic neurons is it's a fascinating area, but as always, it's a new paper. We get very excited about it, but in terms of actually being applied to treat diseases, I'm afraid might still be quite a long way. But, science is all about tiny steps, and this has been quite a breakthrough for this particular study.
In your world, it's a breakthrough, right?
Yeah. Because like I said, now they've made a device that can actually respond to signals from a real neuron and pass it on to other real neurons. And, it's a first step, but very exciting.
Rat neurons.
But,
for now.
But rat neurons and human neurons are very similar.
Okay.
Yeah. It's just when they're all together, how, as a circuit, it may function differently from a human brain because they have, many other things make up a human brain rather than just the neuron itself. But in terms of how the neuron works in a rat, it's the same as how it would work in a human.
Okay, so the human brain is more complex, so there needs to be more understanding. The rat brain, not so complex.
Oh, very complex still. Yeah, very complex. But easier to model, I think that's why they use the animal models first as, like I said, proof of concept that the thing works. And then they can start to worry about how to apply it to humans.
Okay, thank you both very much for joining me today in our Brainwave series on bionic neurons. Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar, neurogeneticist, and Dr. Nuraza Hamzaid from the Department of Biomedical Engineering, University of Malaya.
Azza and her baby.
And the baby, about to pop out next month on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.